a little bit more about me and about the National Center on Accessibility. So we have, NCA has been around for a long time. I think we've officially celebrated our 35th year or coming up on it. As a center, we've always been housed at IU, although we have recently gone through a bit of a redistricting in terms of who we report to and where we live within the university. So as Barbara mentioned, we're sort of tucked underneath the Epley Institute for Parks and Public Lands. So we're sticking with our comfort zone of parks and recreation. We used to be housed within the School of Public Health in the Department of Recreation, Park and Tourism Studies. The School of Public Health sort of kicked us out about a year ago. And then we are now within
I'm going to the kitchen, ma'am.
Just a second, Michelle. If you're talking, please mute. It'll be star six. And okay, Michelle, go ahead.
No problem. Okay. So now that we've left the School of Public Health, we are actually within the Indiana Institute for Disability and Community. They are now who we report to. Within the university, we're within the Vice Provost for Research Office at IIDC. So that's a very recent maneuver that we've undertaken, and we're still sort of getting used to, you know, the new ways of working within IU. We still have remained true to our mission and our scope of what we do, and that's kind of what I'm happy to talk about a little bit today, with some particular areas of emphasis and interest related to the community of people who are blind or have low vision. So that's what we'll cover today. As Barbara mentioned, I've been with NCA for almost a total of 15 years, and it's where I've spent the majority of my career. So I'm just happy to be a part of this organization on an ongoing basis. So NCA works on a variety of programs or projects as our scope tries to remain as true as possible to a recreation focus, but that can mean pretty much anything from aquariums and zoos to parks and public lands, state parks, national parks, you name it. If it has some kind of leisure or recreation focus, we're pretty much interested in that. We provide training primarily to the National Park Service, although we are in the works in talks and back and forth with the State Parks Department in Indiana to develop a training plan for their staff. Our trainings are wide-ranging topics from appropriate interactions with people with disabilities to exhibit design considerations to the built environment standards and policy and procedures and everything in between. If it's related to accessibility in some way, we provide some level of training on it and can customize those trainings to meet the agency's needs. We also provide expert consultation. So we're widely recognized across the country as experts in program and architectural access. We usually come to the table in a consultation session and ask the tough questions that people are either afraid to ask or don't know the answer to and are looking for some creative solutions. So we've been involved with a number of things related to consultation. And as Barbara mentioned, we have worked with the local community or the community of people who are blind or have low vision in Indiana on several of our consulting projects. We also do assessment, which is the evaluation of existing sites for barrier removal opportunities, both quick fixes like, hey, move this thing because it's in somebody's way. And long-term goals, like this entire building needs a redesign. So we've done a fair number of those as well. And the last area that we work in is planning. So if a parks department is looking at some modified or projected uses of park settings, including facilities or interpretation, we'd like to be at the table for those kind of planning projects as well. So it's a pretty wide range of what we do. But as you probably can guess and understand, the accessibility is pervasive. It inserts itself into everything. So that's why we like to be at the table as much as possible. When Barbara and I had a chance to talk, she talked about that areas of museum access and trail access might be of particular interest to this group. So I have prepared a couple of talking points on those two topics. I am absolutely happy to have anyone interrupt me at any time and ask a question. So we'll just get right into it. I'll tell you what I know, and then I have some questions as well for the bigger group if we have time. So in museum access, and what NCA's work has focused on is a lot on the audio and tactile opportunities for engagement and exploration with whatever the content of that exhibit area or museum area happens to be. Independence and equity are absolutely paramount to what we bring to the table as accessibility consultants and advocates. So reproduction objects, for example, that can be closely examined will emphasize rebuilding a historical artifact in a way that can be physically handled and touched, as opposed to bringing out the exact thing or even doing a reproduction that you have to, is so sensitive, you have to wear gloves or something. We really want individuals to get that hands-on immersive experience with that resource. That's why you come to explore a particular exhibit, and we want as much interaction with that resource as possible. And that's what we always advocate for. Those meaningful opportunities to engage with the resource as well are absolutely paramount. So I've been to several national park sites, and some of my favorite things to see in museums and their exhibit areas, I usually take a lot of pictures of things that are like, oops, that didn't quite work out the way somebody planned it to go. For example, I went to Seattle at a national park site there, and this was a long time ago, so I hope they've improved it since then. But they had examples of native tools or tools that the explorers for the gold rush would have used in their exploration. They had the tools on display, and they also had a modern day hammer in comparison on display. And you can guess which one of those items was tactile. It was the modern day hammer. Everybody's seen a hammer. So I hope they've changed that focus.
Yeah.
It's like, oops, didn't quite get there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was also in a park recently that had, I don't remember what the interpretive message was supposed to be, but they had a bottle of syrup, like a jug, a small jug, plastic jug, and a clay pitcher with like these ornate engravings on it. And I'll tell you what, the plastic pitcher was the tactile opportunity.
Oh my gosh.
Best, you know, the best intentions don't always meet the need. So, you know, there's always some humor in that too, because these things seem obvious to us, right? But to exhibit designers and planners and managers of these various areas, it's not always that obvious. So,
I don't know. That makes me wonder when you put a plastic jug out with syrup in it, if they really cared to yeah, I don't know.
Okay. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I love to bring my daughter, she's 5, to zoos and aquariums too. And I've seen several areas now that are integrating tactile opportunities for exploration, which is great, but they'll give me like the ear and the tail of an elephant, but never show me exactly what an elephant looks like, you know? So it's like almost there, but not putting the whole picture together. So those are the kinds of things that we're encountering fairly frequently and trying to establish those best practices and change the narrative of what it means to do and implement meaningful tactile experiences. Mm-hmm. So that's been a huge area of emphasis for us. Mm-hmm. I will say something that's encouraging is that 3D printing and the onboarding of 3D printing opportunities has really expanded availability and the ability of museums and interpretive settings to implement tactile objects, particularly in the area of like prototyping or pilot projects, and trying out different tactile objects and involving their local community and advocacy groups and advisory councils and focus groups, you know, whatever you want to call them. Mm-hmm. Of people with and without disabilities, involving them in saying, you know, how does this work for you? You know, would this be something that you'd like to see in our permanent collection? So that's been encouraging. That's something that's readily available now.
Yeah. And I'll say that we actually talked about having someone speak at our convention about 3D printing. It's, you know, it's really exciting for, you know, the blind community. And but I don't know if we ever if we were able to pull that off this year, but we talked about it. Rita, do you know, did we get anybody for 3D printing?
Not for this year. So I'm hoping that if we're able to have our state convention in Bloomington, we'll have next year, that available next year. Yeah.
Oh, so great. Anyway, it was an exciting idea because we realized that's a one way that we might be able to kind of see something, with our hands when we can't really see it. We can't touch the real thing. So anyway, okay, sorry. Just wanted to interject that.
No problem. Yeah, that's great. That's awesome insight. I do hope it comes to Bloomington. That'd be fun.
Yeah.
So I wanted to offer two examples of projects that we are working on currently or have recently wrapped up that did a really good job or are trying to do the right thing in terms of access, particularly related to the needs of the blind and low vision community. So the first one is Devil's Tower National Monument. And Barbara, you may have been involved in this one. Okay. I know Mary was at one point.
Okay.
They went through a project that developed several new wayside exhibits that interpreted that natural resource. It's a giant thing sticking out of the ground that looks like a clay mold where someone has run their fingers down the side of the monument. And it's just this monumental geographical feature in the middle of nowhere. So they wanted to interpret Devil's Tower for everyone. So what they did was there had been a bronze model in place for years, but the level of detail on that model alone was insufficient to truly appreciate or comprehend the geological feature of the site. So the project went through a robust prototyping process with the exhibit designer and an advisory council of individuals with visual impairments who reviewed the tactile elements at all stages of the design. The exhibit designers took the feedback to heart. They really made changes in real time as the project evolved. Now, this project was a large scale project with a large budget, but the principles and process of the project could be replicated with far less publicity and far fewer funds. Mm-hmm. And I think the ultimate success of the project, I haven't yet gotten to see the installation firsthand, but I did see several of the prototypes. Mm-hmm. I just think that it's successful for anyone. But was particularly of interest to the blind and low vision community.
I think Mary did that. Yeah. I didn't do that. The two that I remember doing was one, a tactile kind of mapping. I believe it was for part of the Capitol building or maybe the Visitors Bureau. Mm-hmm. But and then there was the other one I did was for a boardwalk area. Okay. In California, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, that was like a map, a tactile map.
Yeah. And I just think that the involvement of community members and, real life people who live this experience just brings so much to a project. I wish that it was standard procedure for anybody undergoing a type of interpretive or educational design of those kinds of programs to involve some kind of focus group or advisory council of people with disabilities, because it just makes that project so much richer, makes the outcome so much better. And that's what the other project that we're working on. I'm sorry, somebody wanted to add.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Michelle, this monument or whatever you're talking about, where is it located at?
South Dakota.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay. Have you done, what have you done here in Indiana as far as our museums?
That is a great question. I have not had the privilege or pleasure within my 15 years at NCA working with the museums directly in Indiana. Not me personally.
Okay.
Now, I will say we are just onboarding a graduate student he lives in Indianapolis, but he's pursuing his PhD from IU. He's going to be doing a graduate assistantship with us. I believe he starts next week. He has worked directly with a number of museums in the area. His father, I believe, is a person with a visual impairment, he himself self-identifies as someone on the autism spectrum.
Wow.
So his experience is really going to enrich and enliven even what we do.
Wow.
We're just continuing to learn and grow as our networks expand too. We never ever claim to know it all. And there's always something we could be doing better. So we're really looking forward to working with him establishing stronger connections with facilities and operations that are closer to home here in Indiana for us. I'm really encouraged by the training program that we're developing for the Indiana State Parks as well.
Oh, really? Okay. And what is that about?
That one is just in its infancy, but we're hoping to expand and have training opportunities available for all state parks employees that covers a really wide range of disability-related topics and emphasis areas. So for anyone within the organization, both from the programming side of the house and the facilities and trails and built environment side.
Does anybody have any questions so far or comments about your personal experience maybe at a museum or a park or trail or something? Just anything to either questions or to add to the conversation.
Barbara, this is Carrie. You may have mentioned this, but I didn't hear. But Michelle, do you have a visual impairment?
I do not.
Okay.
There is someone, I don't know if you're thinking, Carrie, there is someone at the works in contract with the National Center for Accessibility that has a vision impairment. It's in contract, I think.
Yes.
Right?
Michelle. Yep, it's in direct contract, and he's been my mentor over the years. So
yeah,
he's a lovely person.
So he actually lives here in Bloomington, but he works for the National Parks and I know that. Go ahead, Dolly. Is that you?
Okay, yeah. I have a question. Like our history museums, do they have to be under the ADA?
Yeah.
Our Lawrence County History Museum or Marion County History Museum, do they have to follow the ADA guidelines?
Yes, ma'am, they do.
Okay, and then how do they do that when they change their
exhibits-based
items? Yeah, exhibits, you know. It's hard for their funding anyway to keep the museum open. You know, it's hard to keep. I mean, they probably could get grants from some area.
They could get grants, but if they're doing a changing exhibit or bringing some new content online, anything that's been being done that is new, the guidance from the Access Board, the Department of Justice, and all kinds of places is that anything that's being done new, whether it's programming or a permanent installation or a fixture, needs to be brought online as an accessible thing. Most smaller operations have a harder time justifying it and say that it's going to cost more. The narrative that we have been promoting as a center is that if you design it to be accessible, it will meet the needs not only of people with disabilities, but everyone.
Yeah.
So we've been trying to promote that that narrative for a very, very long time.
Now, when you say they have to comply with ADA, do you mean not just the accessibility of the building, but the content of the programming that they're providing?
Yeah, that's correct.
And so I mean, there could be they just have to make it accessible. Do they actually detail how? They could do a number of things to make something accessible.
Right. Correct. The terminology in the legislation is it has to be effectively communicated. So the way that a visual element gets effectively communicated to someone who does not have vision is usually through audio or tactile experiences or a combination of both.
Right.
So that's what we've been promoting as the way to do things is through audio or audio descriptive tours. As well as select those meaningful artifacts or opportunities that you could potentially make tactile So to have that more immersive experience and doing both of those things in combination is really meaningful.
And with 3D printing seems 3D printing seems affordable, or it will become more and more affordable. Go ahead, Dolly. What were you going to say?
If they have a volunteer who's a guide, would that help on some of that then? I mean, they can't have buttons every display. I can't imagine, you know. But if a guide takes you around, would that be the same? Although they wouldn't be able to touch it, but if they describe it. And my other thing is when I visited the Asheville, North Carolina, the Vanderbilt Home Museum, when we walked in, we were able to get a little tape recorder and a tape and earphones. And it was really neat because it told you, you're walking, just keep walking to your left and you'll enter the such and such room. Mm-hmm. And on the walls are, and then they described what was on the walls, what paintings and et cetera. Now, I don't think they have that anymore with cassettes.
You know, that's interesting because I think even doing that little bit, just describing what is in the environment, what's in the room, what's on the walls, what's on the floor, what does the mantle look like? I mean, that alone, to me, I mean, it's like something that you really appreciate. Maybe they could have done more, but it's like, wow, I never knew that before, you know? So well, it's like, yeah.
I know because I had the earphones on and she said in my ear, you know, the tape said, now you're entering the red room or something. And then if you look to your left or on your left, there's a Baroque painting. And I called Mike and I says, hey, Mike, there's a Baroque painting right here, up here. Everybody heard me. They thought I was so smart. They all came running towards me and looking.
Yeah. So you could have been the tour guide.
So, yeah, but the other thing is, having somebody, the tactile would be good in the museums, and then having a personal guide, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I told Michelle of an experience that the Heartland chapter had when we did a tour of the Indiana, Indianapolis Museum of Art, I think it is, maybe the IMA. I think that's what it is. They had like this humongous, like structure that was made of hay bales. I mean, enormous. And, you know, we were allowed to touch it. Now, get this. This is hay bales, okay? And we had to wear gloves. So I was like, oh, my gosh, this is too much.
Yeah. Best intentions, not quite there. Dolly, your comment actually brings up a really interesting point about when we're doing evaluations of sites or consultations. What you said about, you know, just that welcoming, like here you are in space and on your right or on your left, this is what you're going to experience. That element of like orientation is absolutely key with being a welcoming site to people with disabilities. That's our pathway when we go to a site or a museum, a park, what have you. We take the pathway of the visitor because we don't want to see your grand, we don't want to see like the grand thing. We want to know what the visitor experiences and right. Think about the lens of that visitor experience and let that drive whatever kind of accessibility improvements might be necessary. And that's really fun. It's like a big puzzle, right? And I love puzzles. So I think that's why people are successful in this type of career is, it is absolutely, there's not a one size fits all approach, to accessibility at all. There's a prescription for some things, but most things are very much like, what can we do? Let's put on our creative and our, critical thinking hats and come up with the best solution here.
Yeah. Anybody else have an experience with a museum or a park or trail that was interesting, good or bad?
Yeah. This is Rita. When I lived in Mississippi, our chapter of the American Council of the Blind down there, we took a field trip to the art museum in Jackson, Mississippi. And when we went in, They arranged for us to have a guide. I don't know, there's maybe a dozen of us, something like that. But first, we went into this room that they put items on shelves until they're ready to be put actually into an exhibit or whatever. But when we were in that room, that's when they, like you were saying, Barbara, they gave everybody a pair of gloves. And blind people don't like gloves because it takes away from our sense of touch.
Yeah, that's so, how anyway, we see.
Yeah. So then we walk into the main room, which is, you know, it's got different sections and stuff. And now this museum, it not only had paintings, it had sculptures and and then this one display, because these were like Mississippi artists, I believe. Mm-hmm. This one display we couldn't touch, but it was, I guess, technically a sculpture, but it was a real bed, like a wrought iron bed, with a woman laying in the bed on her stomach, and apparently she looked naked with a sheet kind of draped over her. Well, you know, obviously we weren't allowed to touch that sculpture. We could touch the stone sculptures or carvings or whatever. So that one, the guide had to describe it, and it was so detailed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, and the artist shows the hairs on her leg that is sticking mm-hmm. out under the sheet, you know, mm-hmm. Things like that. Now, I wasn't that, since the only thing I really got to feel was those sculptures, you know, carvings and things, and a lot of it was like modern. It was hard mm-hmm. to feel and interpret what you were feeling, really, to me.
Yeah.
But,
because you have the gloves on. That was made it harder.
Yeah, and the gloves, and the gloves. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one thing that I think would be wonderful mm-hmm. is, you know, if you're in a museum, for example, and I'm thinking like, and I don't know, years and years ago, I went to the Smithsonian, so I can't remember everything because I was a kid, but if I were going there now, some of those things that you're not allowed to touch, it would be nice if in front of the display they had a model of whatever it was that you could touch.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have the dinosaurs that, you know, it's the bones.
Mm-hmm.
If they had a small model, I mean, blind kids who've never seen huge things like that, you know, if there was a model of it that they could get a feel for what the big thing looks like and,
mm-hmm.
you know, if,
mm-hmm.
I think models of some of these things that you can't mm-hmm. touch mm-hmm. would be really cool.
You know, and
some of those things are so fragile, mm-hmm. you know, there's no way you can touch it anyway.
Right. Yeah, anyway. And I think it's important to realize, and this was an interview that Cassandra, I can never say her name, Yael Cassandra with WFIU, when she followed us around at the IMA, she did an interview with one of our members, and she this particular member was blind from birth, and she talked about uh-huh. how she sees things in parts, in pieces. She doesn't uh-huh. see a whole tree. She's only can see the tree in pieces or parts, and then she has to put it together. And I think that's a really good way to think about it when you've never seen before, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think, but anyway, so Michelle, what else can you tell us, or do you have any questions for us?
I do actually have a question that Dolly brought it up, mm-hmm. and maybe you can expand on it a little bit. I'm curious about the preference for live guide or a guided tour type situation versus a recorded narration of a particular area or exhibit. If there are preferences for that, and if you've had any particularly good or really not so good experiences.
I don't think a recorded tour of our historical museum down here would work for us. It's not a large museum where the exhibits are spaced out and everything, you've got a lot of stuff crammed in together.
So Dolly, I don't think, yeah. And Dolly, what did you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I guess I, in a way, I can't remember what museum I was at, either Science and Industry in Chicago or what, but they had like little buttons that you could push and you'd hear, you know, what's behind the glass. But, I think and that's okay too, but then, you know, kids get to playing with all those buttons too. But, either way, if you were on a tour and you had a guide, it would be nice, except when there's like 15 people with you.
Yeah. And everybody asks questions and then you really don't really get a full description. I liked the what they did for you, Dolly, at the Biltmore. Because, I mean, it was independence because you didn't have to, I mean, you were operating it and it wasn't out in the open where everybody else could come by and push the buttons and play with it. You know what I mean? I don't know if that makes a difference or not, but.
They follow the rail or whatever and go into the next room and you'll be in the, you know, and automatically comes on, you're in the such and such room.
Yeah,
it was wonderful.
Don't they do that kind of a recorded tour of the White House, where you can listen to it while you're walking through?
I brought that up to Michelle, and when I went to the White House, I do not remember there being any recorded material, and we just walked through. Everything was behind ropes, and it was a little frustrating. There was no description, really, whatever was on the outside of those ropes, boy, I did it. I felt that thing all over, and I wanted them to tell me not to do it.
Yeah.
Because I was a little frustrated that, you know, nothing was really there for me to see.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, did anybody else had any experience with museums? Or we've heard from Rita and Dolly. And if you have any other questions for us, Michelle.
I don't have any other questions at this point.
Okay. Anybody else have any other questions for Michelle or any experiences you'd like to talk about or share your experiences?
How about the trail? Like in Kentucky, we went to Natural Something Bridge. I'm trying to think. Do you remember, Mike, what it was? I'm sorry, what?
Kentucky?
Natural State Park. And we took we didn't take a tour, but we got way up high on the mountain by the lift, and I was scared to death. So I said, I'm going to take the trail down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 2 hours to get down, but it was kind of dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Well, down that trail. There were great big vines or whatever blocking your, you know, you had to climb over. And then one time Mike says, if you're going to fall to the left. I said, why? He says, you don't want to know.
Oh, my.
Okay.
I mean, that trail, it can only be one person, you know, like a, and then
I oh, my gosh. You didn't ask enough questions, Dolly. You never got me mixed up on that one.
Well,
I'm scared. I don't like heights. I can feel heights. I don't have to see them. I can feel them. Ugh, I hate them.
Yeah.
But anyway,
yeah.
Does anybody else have any other comments or questions? I thought I heard somebody a while ago. Jerry.
Yes. This is Jerry.
Yeah.
When we went to Rome several years ago now, back in 2007, when we went to the museum, the Vatican Museum there, when you go to the museum, you end up in the Sistine Chapel. But when we went through there the first time, of course, we were in a tour at that point, and we went back on our own. And I had heard that if you ask, you could set up a deal where you could feel things.
Mm-hmm.
So we asked about that, and she said, well, we just have to assign you a guard. And they did, and the guard took down, they had us, it was just our family, and the guard took down the ropes, certain rooms, and I got to touch anything and everything I wanted. I mean, it was marvelous. It was, you know,
that's amazing. Yeah,
yeah, it was wonderful.
Amazing. That's amazing. Wow, what an experience! I would have loved that.
Yeah. Wow. It was wonderful.
Yeah,
you know, because I could touch the Egyptian bath and the you know, all these different statues and of people and animals and you know, ever. I mean, it was just.
God.
That was great.
That's stunning. I can't believe that. Wow.
Yeah, a couple excited people came by.
And did you have to wear gloves, Jerry? did they make you wear gloves?
Not back in 2007, they didn't.
Yeah. Okay, somebody else was going to say something. Mike, was it you?
It could have been. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, I'd like to make a couple comments. I find that where I grew up sighted and now pretty much lost my sight, I find that I take two different dimensions. In the past, I would have enjoyed looking at beautiful art and painting. And now when people describe it, they'll say, you know, the painting of two people, one doing this and that. That didn't really mean anything to me anymore. I want to hear it from a different angle, like, you know, why was that painting painted? What makes it so special? Why do sighted people like that painting? You know, the kind of information like that. I guess what I'm saying is I want to look at things from a whole different perspective than if I was sighted.
You're also looking at it from the perspective of an engineer, Mike.
Okay.
Yeah. So you're
that's actually that's a really great point though, Mike, because the one thing that I wrote as like a closing thought, and we don't have to close with this, but it's relevant to bring it up now, is that one of the things that that we promote to recreation site administrators is that information plus choice equals a quality recreational experience. And what I mean by choice is that level of engagement with the resource, or with the artifact, or with the opportunity. So like you said, you enjoy that background information of, you know, what makes this thing exciting and unique, and all the ins and outs of a thing. Whereas kind of when I go to a museum, I'm very much a give me the key point and get out. Like I breeze through museums. It's not my thing to understand that level of detail, but I respect and understand that it is other people's choice to experience museums in that way. So that's one of those things that we try and emphasize.
And I could say that, Mike, because of course Rhett, you know, is an engineer, and he would probably say the same thing you just said. And of course he has vision, and he would want to know, you know, why and so on and so forth, you know. So yeah.
Have you ever heard anybody on the call about the there's a term in the museum industry where visitors are referred to as either streakers, strollers, or studiers, and I am a total streaker.
I have to say, when we went to Charleston last year, Charleston, South Carolina, our daughter met us there, and she is a deep sea diver. So we visited the aquarium. And I got a great description of all these sea animals and sea turtles, and because she was so excited about them, and she had seen some of these things in the wild, and that was kind of neat. And then also going through a plantation, and you know, just walking down these, we went through trails and trails and trails of plantation, you know, different types of forests. And I was like, oh my gosh, but she was so into it that she was describing it. And I'd never seen bamboo. Okay, I've only seen tiny pieces of bamboo. Well, this was enormous pieces, you know, bamboo plants. And it was cool to touch it. It almost felt like metal, or, you know, not metal exactly, but it was cool to the touch. And I thought that was just so fascinating. But anyway, it's just amazing, you know, and I think, you know, you really appreciate it when you get to put your hands on it.
Yeah.
So,
Bob, when we went, we were in near San Diego visiting our son a couple years ago, and that lives out there. And he took us to, I think it was an aquarium in San Diego. And there they had, you know, those sea animals and stuff and those things in the water. And the guy just, he told me, just reach your hand down in there and find this little guy. And I did. I mean, it was, oh, they felt so funny and so weird and slimy. But the fact that I could
I'm not sure they could have talked me into that.
I don't like to touch slimy stuff or anything, but I did. I mean, it was in the water. I did. Go ask them if I could, touch that stuff. And they said, sure. So,
amazing.
I did.
Great. Okay. Well, we're so anybody else have anything short to say or anything, any experiences or comments or questions for Michelle as we come up to the 8 o'clock hour?
Okay. I got a couple quick questions. You mentioned you moved from Morton's office to somewhere on 10th Street. Where on 10th Street did you say that was?
Yeah, we are in the Smith Research Center. So it's a big building tucked back behind, kind of between the IIDC building, the Indiana Institute for Disability and Community, and the infrastructure campus there, where all the servers are housed and stuff like that. It's back in that area.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So that's on the east side of the bypass?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay. 10th and the bypass. Yeah. Okay. So any other questions?
Ray Boomer still with you?
Yes, he is. Okay, yep. Ray's a good buddy of mine. I talk to him almost every day.
He's a neighbor of yours, Mike, right?
Yeah.
Close by.
Another question. This is kind of a local question. In Bloomington, they like to have a lot of trails. Is there anything that the Bloomington City to do to make their walking trail more accessible? And if you had to rate one, is one more accessible than the other?
Yeah, sure. The majority of the Beeline Trail is an extremely accessible trail. I like it for a variety of reasons. It's nice and wide. It's mostly flat. I just like it. It's a good one. The thing that I would love to see the city of Bloomington do, and most trail administrators or managers do, is have more orientation signage that integrates tactile opportunities. I mean, I was just at home visiting my family in Philadelphia and had an opportunity to take the public transit over into the city. I actually had an appointment with Wills Eye Hospital. And I was standing on the platform of the Patco train, and wouldn't you know it, they have a tactile map. And I'm like, okay, if the city of Philadelphia public transit can have a tactile map. just about anybody can figure this out. It's not that hard. That's one of the things that I think is an up and coming area of accessibility is trail signage in general. There's some really cool things being done with trail signage, but most of it is strictly visual. It's not tactile yet.
Or at least audibly descriptive.
Exactly. So that's one of the areas where we're really trying to expand and influence people to do some cutting edge things that can be replicated very easily. So,
and I think it's important. Sometimes I think we forget that sometimes as blind people, I think people think as we're all audible learners, but we're kind of forced to be kind of audible learners in a way, you know, because that's what works for us, or at least some of us have hard of hearing though. But, I think for me, I like to know my surroundings. I like to know what is around me. What am I walking past? I'm a very visual person, and I visualize. I love that orientation piece. Yeah. I like when you talked about that.
Yeah, I did a
where am I at and what's around me.
Exactly. You know? I had a meeting with the Rails to Trails Conservancy recently, and one of the areas of emphasis there was those connections of what are you experiencing along this trail? Is it strictly a natural area? Are you passing by an urban development where you can stop and get an ice cream cone halfway through your hike? You know, those are the things that are important to understand and really critical to experiencing that environment and that setting or that community. So that was a really rich discussion about understanding those various connections. It's not just about the trail itself, but it's about what you're being surrounded by.